All right, welcome everyone to another Tuesday afternoon here in America, Tuesday evening in Ireland, Scotland, elsewhere in Europe where this is being broadcast. This is actually being broadcast all over the world on four streams. PSN Radio, I'm on Shake and Wake on both of their streams. Shake and Wake Radio, thanks to Annie, and peoplesinternetradio.com, based in Ireland and Scotland. So welcome everyone. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is Cancel the Cabal. I've been a researcher for about 10 years now, actually, and if my guest would like to hear about that, I will tell him, but if he doesn't, that's not a big deal. He has been a researcher at least from what I could find as long as I've been alive, 1964. That was the year I was born, and he's been doing it that long, maybe even longer, so I want to bring on G. Edward Griffin. Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Stephen. My pleasure. And it's especially, it's kind of exciting and interesting to know that you have such an international audience. It's nice to speak to a lot of people around the world at one time. It's amazing.
Well, yeah, thank you. I did mention as early as I could find it, it was 1964, but how far does your researching and activism, does it go back further than that?
A little bit further, yeah. I took my first red pill. I guess it was late in 1959, so I began to discover some things. But by 1960, I was pretty much in crusader mode, and I knew that I had to do something. At least I felt that way. I still do. And so, yeah, 1960 really was my entry point into this real world. So, yeah, it goes back a long time, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. I mentioned, mine's been 10 years. I got my first computer in Christmas 2008. I had it given to me. I had heard all of the stories back in the 80s and 90s and, the early 2000s about computers. They were just going to be intrusive and they were going to collect our data and they were going to spy on us. And, well, you know, it turns out that it was all true. But anyways, I've been doing this since early 2009.
Wow. Well, so you've been in it for a little while too. So,
yes.
That's the great thing about, back a little bit, I have a tendency, probably a bad tendency, to back up to look at the big picture. And every once in a while I back up so far, I feel like I'm out in outer space looking down on this little planet Earth and at myself, a little speck on that planet. And one of the reasons I say that is because just this morning, a little discussion with my wife over the breakfast table about how small and insignificant we are and how everything is cyclical. And we're just like a little spark that comes on and goes off. And it's an instant in time. But it seems like our only purpose is to procreate and then we're gone. And then we started talking, but yeah, well, procreation of ideas is important too. Maybe that's why we're here. It's not just to procreate our species, but to procreate ideas. And, you know, those things, they're fascinating. You never answer these questions, of course, but I think it's important that we think about those questions now and then, because it gives this kind of a humility about ourselves and the perspective of what we're trying to do. We are just a little spark or a grain of sand on the beach. But each one of us, you know, we're there for a reason. And even that grain of sand is there for a reason, I suppose, if we could understand it. That reason is probably equal in importance to the big picture as we are. And we don't like to think of that, of course, because we like to think we're pretty high up the food chain and on importance. So I'm rambling a little bit, but it made me think about what you just said. You know, we're part of the cycle. And there's one of the things I've observed about natural law, which has always been a topic that I've been interested in. What is this thing called natural law? Those are the big immutable laws of the universe and of life. And one of them I figured out a long time ago was that everything is cyclical. Everything is cyclical. And that's a humbling thought, because it means that we were designed to be phased out and on and on and on. But yes, but the main point, and I guess the reason for my thinking that that's important to even mention, is that when we contemplate these things, we, at least I do, I come to the conclusion that I'm here for a reason. And even though I don't understand it really completely or even partially probably, I know that there is a reason, and whatever it is, it's programmed into me. It's part of my genetic code. And I don't have to understand it necessarily. I don't have to read a book or have somebody explain it to me. It's programmed into me, and I think it's programmed into all of us. And I think if we just open up our minds and get our egos out of the way and just listen to that quiet of the universe and the quiet of the mind, we'll know what to do because we're driven to do it. And I think being in this movement, this freedom movement is the best way to describe it, I suppose. This struggle for human dignity, human liberty, human fulfillment against the powers of constraint and slavery and control. It's probably why we're here. It's probably why people like you and me and many of your listeners out there do things that are not profitable to them. Sometimes it's at great cost to ourselves and money and time and reputation even and convenience. And we do these things. Why? Because we're driven to do them, because we respond in a way to that strange concept that we all have. And that is that it's the right thing to do. So those are my opening thoughts this morning. I don't know that that's what you wanted to hear, but you asked me a question that triggered all those things.
Yeah.
So I just open it up and let it dump out.
No, it's all good. It's all good. I'm not concerned about you going on a rant or anything like that.
No rants today. I don't think so. You never know.
I just wanted to touch upon one thing that you just happened to, it kind of spurred a idea in my head, which you were just talking a few minutes ago there. I have caught, well, I guess it was articles a few weeks back. I didn't save it, but I should have. But in the early part of the 20th century, a lot of the criticism of the Rothschild and Rockefeller funded schools, a lot of the schooling policies, they were criticized, and it was pretty much, you could almost put 2019 on the date of the people that were criticizing it, because they were saying the exact same things. They're doing nothing but brainwashing our children. They're going to take control of our children. They're going to turn our children against us. And this was all back in the early 19-teens. 1906 is one article I caught, and beyond. I don't believe that there's any falsehood in that statement. Do you?
Yeah, I think it's totally false, because I don't think this is going to happen. I think it's already happened.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, I don't think there's any falsehoods in their statements way back then, 100 plus years ago.
No, I was just trying to be a little clever with that statement. And yeah, it's absolutely true. And that movement was started at the turn of the last century. And you were quite right. It was funded. It took a lot of money to get this thing started. And it was funded by the Carnegie Foundation,
yes,
and the Rockefellers. And the money went specifically to Columbia University and their teachers' college. And these people, they've written books, by the way, about it. That's why I can speak with absolute authority on it, because it's not my opinion. All I did was read their books.
Correct. It's in their own writings, yeah.
Yeah, and they explain exactly what they intend to do. This is like 100 years ago. They said they intend to do what we now see having been done. So, and they said that, you know, what they had to do was eliminate this concept of individualism out of our culture, the idea of individual responsibility, individual worth and importance, and replace it with the idea of collectivism, which is the idea that the group is more important than the individual, and that the individual must be sacrificed if necessary, you know, for the greater good of the greater number, which is like how they like to explain it, makes it sound good. So, and they said, this is what we have to do. We have to change America and the whole Western world, they said, to get rid of this outdated and outmoded and terribly selfish ideology of individualism, individual worth, and replace it with this concept of collectivism, which is that the individual must serve the collective, must serve the group. And of course, in their mind, that meant serve the state. And so, yeah, they wrote books about it and they spent money on it and they made huge grants of money to Columbia University. And along with the money, of course, came the privilege of being able to name the heads, the chairs of the departments at the teachers' college, and to pick the men who were going to write the textbooks and to determine the curricula. And they did all of that. And so what we see today is merely the manifestation of what they set out to do. And their goal was to, first of all, train the teachers so the teachers can teach the teachers who can teach the teachers who can teach the kids. And they said, if we can do this for a couple of generations, we'll have it done. We will put an end to the old American way of individualism and replace it with a system. And by the way, this is in the words of, I think it was Mr. Gaither, who was with the Ford Foundation at the time. I think I got that right. One of the big foundations at any rate, said that their goal was to sort of change life in the United States so that it could be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union. They actually said that. That was their goal. And you think, well, good grief, that's terrible. We're going to merge the United States with a communist country? Well, they didn't think of it as a communist country. They understood that the word communism, they understood, no, nobody else seemed to understand it, but they understood that the word communism was merely a label for something much more fundamental. They understood that there was no difference between communism and fascism and Nazism. They understood that the real thing they were talking about is collectivism, because all those other ideologies are merely variations of this deeper and more solidly defined concept of collectivism, the supremacy of the group over the individual. Yeah, in other words, collectivism, that's the enemy. And so they were really collectivists. And so when they said that they wanted to comfortably merge the United States with the Soviet Union, it wasn't that they wanted to bring about communism, but they wanted to bring about collectivism, which is what communism is based on. So they wanted to change the ideals of the American people so we could continue to carry the American flag if we wanted to. And the Russians can continue to carry the hammer and sickle, and all the other communist countries and socialist countries and fascist countries too can carry their own images on the flags and speak their own languages and so forth. But underneath, they would all agree. They'd all have the same ideology and the same judicial system, the same cultural mores,
yes,
as everybody else. And that was the beginning of the concept of building a global collectivist system, which these people since then started to call the New World Order. That was their word for it. But before they called it the New World Order, they just called it bringing about global reform on behalf of collectivism.
Certainly. I find it interesting. Winston Churchill is reportedly to have said that he didn't have any problem with National Socialism, and he didn't have any problem with Hitler. His problem was with the German people. They were the strength. There was a deeply religious country, 1930s Germany, and it's just, well, I do also want to say that college political science did teach me that there was only collectivism and individualism. Collectivism come in the form of fascism or Marxism or communism or socialism. But it all boiled down to collectivism.
Right. Well, that's amazing. You are the first person, actually, that I've ever heard say that they learned that in school. I thought that was long gone by the time you were in school. It was gone when I got to the University of Michigan. There was nothing left of that at the university.
Is that right?
And that was 19, I guess I went in there in 1954. And at least it wasn't in any of the classes that I took or the textbooks that I was given. No, it was all about democracy, which is another way of saying collectivism, actually, you know, sure. The greater good of the greater number. The democracy is the people speak and let whatever the majority wants, the majority gets. That's
good for the collective.
Yeah, for the collective. Yeah. So all of that was the idea of individualism and this magic word called the Republic, you know, all of that was gone and replaced by some kind of a passionate loyalty and love of this word democracy. We fought a word to save democracy. Well, God help us. Our founding fathers thought democracy was about the worst form of government, and they said so.
Didn't George Bush and Dick Cheney say that they were actually going to bring democracy to Iraq and Afghanistan?
Oh, yeah, of course. And they did.
Yeah.
Look at Iraq. You see it. There it is. And, of course, that's what we now have in the United States pretty much. We have made this transition, unfortunately, from a republic, which is a restriction on what the majority can do. That's basically the simplified way is the difference between a republic and a democracy. I mean, there are many differences, but the major overall concept is that under a democracy, the majority can do anything it wants to do. If you can get 51% of the vote, you can do anything. There are no limits. The majority rule, the greater good of the greater number. And that means that if the majority decides that everybody with red hair should be executed, I'm sorry about you, redhead guys, but it's, you know, greater good of the greater number. That's democracy. It's a lynch mob in action. There's only one dissenting vote, and he's at the end of the rope. That's democracy. But now when you say, that's the idea that the people should have a voice in government without having absolute unlimited scope over what they can do to their fellow citizens if they happen to gain the majority for a little bit. If you say, well, let's put some limitations on what the majority can do. Now you're beginning to talk about a republic. And that's not taught in school anymore. When I got into the university, that was all gone. I had to dig that stuff out of the old textbooks. We ought to teach it again.
Yes. Yes, we absolutely do. Well, that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this. It was just after Barack Obama's second inauguration. I was still in college. I was in the BA program, in the business program of mass communications, or journalism class. And I decided to take a hiatus and start to research internet radio and video podcasting and all that kind of stuff. And I started doing that just after 2013. But it was just after Obama's second inauguration when I started it.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious as to your statement about learning the real difference between the two great ideological positions available in the world. I mean, I have a chapter in my upcoming book, not published yet, but it's one of my first chapters called The Chasm. And it deals with this deep divide between there are only two political views in the Western world as to what the proper function of the state should be, proper legalized use of legalized force. And it's collectivism versus individualism. I had to go and find all of that. And I was not aware that anybody was teaching that. So what school were you in when you were taught that?
University of Phoenix. It was an online course, online classes.
An online class.
I would have to go back into the syllabuses. I still have them and find out where they were printed and produced and what their sources were. But
well, that's interesting. Well, I'm sure glad that it was still there in some remnant
yes,
form.
Absolutely.
Who knows? Maybe it still is.
Absolutely.
It might still be there.
I also wanted to tell, I think it was also a political science class that they taught me that the left, the political left and the political right set it up purposefully to where they would protect themselves and only have two parties in the system, no matter what. They had to protect themselves, the left and the right, from the beginning, you know, back in the 1790s when they set it all up.
Well, that's an interesting concept. I wouldn't be surprised, but I have not seen the history on that to document it, but it certainly makes sense because we know in retrospect that there's no difference between the left and the right. They're both versions of the same collectivism underneath. The Nazis, I mean, if you assume that the right is represented by Nazism or fascism and the left is represented by communism, if that's your definition of left and right, then there's no question that they're both the same. It's just the names, because they both believe. I've been able to identify 8 significant differences between individualism and collectivism, and in all of these groups on the left and the right, they agree on all 8 of those principles. There's absolutely no disagreement. You know, like the idea that the individual must be sacrificed for the greater good of greater number. That's yes. found in communism and in fascism.
Yes, it is.
The idea that the origin of rights comes from the state, or it's built into the individual. Some would say God-given rights. Others would say, well, I don't know about God-given rights, but at least individuals have them when they're born. They're innate. It's hardware, not software. It's, you know, comes with the package. It's not added to it. And so all individualists believe that, you know, that the rights come with the individual, and all collectivists, I don't care whether communist, fascist, that's all that, they all believe that the state grants you your rights. And you can go down all of these 8 principles, and on everything, they're always in total agreement. And when I became aware of that, which was in the 60s, by the way, it was a blowaway epiphany, because here I had thought that if we didn't like communism, we had, and they're on the left, we had to be on the right, because the right was against communism, I thought. Well, they were. They were not against communism. They were against the communists. They wanted the power. They wanted the same to do the same thing, but they didn't want the Nazis to have the power. The communists wanted them to have the power, and vice versa. You know, the Nazis and the fascists didn't want the communists to have the power. They wanted the power. And so it was a contest over who was going to rule this despotic system, not what kind of a system it was going to be. And once I got that idea, I thought, oh, my gosh, I've been a fool all these years. Well, not many, but to me, it seemed like a lot of years. But I was thinking that you had to choose between the right and the left, like the same thing going on today. You have to choose. You're either a Republican or a Democrat. And, you know, oh, my gosh, they're the same. And that, I think, is what you're talking about. If you control both sides of a debate, you win, right? No matter which side wins, you win, because
correct.
They're both your side.
And you fund both sides.
Yes. And you fund both sides. It's like owning 2 baseball teams and having them go and play against each other. You win either way.
Yes.
It's so simple once you see it.
Just a quick statement there, here, and then you can make a comment on it. My stepfather is going to be 79 very soon here. He told me in 1959 it would have been the government or economics class or whatever it was called back then. That's what it was called when I was in high school. It was government and economics. But he said his government teacher told him the country had to have a war every 10 years to sustain its itself. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, that is a classical viewpoint of Machiavellian mentality. I don't know if you've ever had a chance to read Machiavelli's The Prince. I've heard about it and I read quotes from it, but I was doing a project a little while ago and I thought, okay, I guess it's time for me to actually get the book and read it. And I was quite surprised to find out that Machiavelli was misrepresented. He was giving advice on what to do if you wanted to maintain power. He wasn't saying it was good. He was not saying he really thought it was an honorable or a proper thing to do. He was simply saying, okay, you've hired me as your advisor, king or prince. He was appealing to the princes. I think this was the Italian state princes and so forth. And he was looking for a job really when he wrote that book. And he was passing it around because there had been some revolutions and overthrows. He was looking for a new employer. So he wrote this book hoping to impress, you know, some of these princes to hire him as an advisor, and it eventually happened. But anyway, that's an interesting side story to it. Basically, what Machiavelli was simply saying, look, whether you like this or not, this is not to say that this is ethical or moral or anything else, but if you want to stay in power, this is what you have to do. And so it was written from that perspective. And if you put yourself in that worldview, you have to agree with Machiavelli. if you're saying, okay, my only job here is not to do what is right, but simply to maintain power and overcome my opposition, who is using similar tactics against me. If I want to stay alive, in other words, this is what I have to do. So when you tell me about this professor saying we have to have a war every 10 years, it's Machiavelli speaking. He's probably, whoever said that probably thinks this is a really lousy kind of world to live in, but that's the world in which we live. And so I really, okay, you asked me my response to that, and I have to say that, unfortunately, from the perspective of a Machiavellian viewpoint, it's true. But it's unfortunate because that assumes that we are content with the systems in which we live. If we like the kind of a system where we have granted all power to the government, if we like that, if this is what we really think is the ideal, and governments are really plundering their people instead of protecting them, and they're really setting up systems of favoritism for their sponsors instead of treating all people equally, if we like that, and that's the system we're trying to preserve, well, then, yes, the answer is we have to have a war every 10 years or thereabout, because otherwise if things get too normal, people begin to get kind of ticked off by what's going on. They're unhappy. They begin to resist. They begin to push back against government policies which are too expensive, and they see that politicians are corrupt and nothing is working, and their freedoms are being taken away. So there's rebellion about to happen. Well, how do you put down rebellion without sending soldiers into the street? Simply get into a war. You say, everybody, stop your quarreling now. This is no time to worry about politics. We must unify behind our leader because we have the enemy attacking us. And if we don't get united and stop worrying about high taxes and the loss of a few liberties here and there, we're going to be invaded and destroyed. And then you'll really be sorry then. So when this professor spoke about we've got to have a war every 10 years, what he really was saying, I believe, is that in order to sustain a corrupt, plundering system and keep the people from rebelling, then we have to have a war every 10 years.
Probably.
Or nowadays, not every 10 years, but a constant war.
Yes.
We've been at war ever since the end of World War II.
Yes,
we have. More wars going on now, little wars, more people dying as a result of combat. There's more money being spent for defense, attack, and I mean, we are in a state of perpetual war now. And that, I believe, is the primary reason for it, because dictators on all sides of these battles benefit from that, because if it weren't for that state of constant conflict, their people would want real, genuine reform. But as long as a leader can come to their people and say, well, I can't tell you about what we did here because of national security.
Yes, yes.
Well, no, you're unpatriotic if you insist on asking more questions. And so they can get away with murder and say, well, we can't discuss it because it's national security.
That's right.
Yeah. So under those conditions, yes, we have to have a war. But now let's talk about, is there a better way? Of course, there's a better way than that. If we had a real system, a state based on the principles of defense and not aggression. In other words, if we all agreed that the proper function of the state was not to provide for this person and provide for me and teach me that and do all these things to provide, but all I want the state to do is to protect my life, liberty, and property. If I said that's it, everything else is taboo, then there would be no reason for wars, because nobody would be complaining about what the government was doing to them. It would be protecting them, and that's it. They wouldn't be redistributing the wealth or giving benefits to this group or denying that group a certain privilege because now they've got to get, you know, adjust society and do all this social engineering and stuff. That's what causes dissent and discontent against their government. If government was put into the proper role of simply defending the life, liberty, and property of its citizens, then we wouldn't need a war at all. In fact, I don't think there would be any war. I don't think there would be any war going on in the world, because there'd be no reason to feel that need to use government as a force of aggression against somebody to get the stuff that they have. Most of these collectivist systems disguise their motives in terms of social justice, okay? But when you peel all that off, really what it all amounts to is that they want our stuff. and they're looking for some way to make it sound like they're good people in wanting our stuff. They said, well, we want your stuff because we think you have too much of it. And this poor person over here needs more, but we still want your stuff. You see, and it comes to us first. And then we decide how much we keep to administer the system. And we might give a little bit to this poor sap over here. As long as he behaves and does exactly what we tell him to do, we'll let him have some of your stuff. But most of it stays with us. You know, that's the same old game throughout history.
Certainly. I've tried to ask a lot of people, both personally that I know and also on social media, and that why are these billionaires all over the world, why are they pushing, well, of course it's collectivism, but I use the word socialism. Why are they pushing socialism? If you look at socialism on paper, they should be the ones, the billionaires and the millionaires should be the ones that are running as fast as they can away from it. But they're not.
Yeah. Well, that's because you shouldn't look at socialism on paper. You look at socialism in reality and in practice.
Right.
In the books, it sounds so glorious and so good and so pure and so
it does.
Wonderful. But in reality, human nature has a way of getting involved there. And they see, as I said just a moment ago, some of these people may start out with good intentions. They want to help the downtrodden and the poor and the weak. But being put in position of readministering everything and redistributing wealth and telling everybody what to do and what they can't do, it's a very heady power, and it corrupts people. And if it doesn't corrupt the people that are in there now, eventually they're going to die, and they'll be replaced by somebody else who maybe is already corrupted, and that's the reason he wants to go into government service in the first place. It's just a question of time. Once you say in your mind, I want government to take care of me, I want government to, you know, provide all these things. And so I'm willing to give government a lot of money and power over me and everybody else so I can get these goodies, these be protected and, you know, have money. I never have to worry about a meal, have a place to live, get health care, education, all this stuff. If I want to be given these benefits, once we do that, we have turned up the juice on a magnet. We've turned the voltage up on this electromagnet, and it's has such a strong magnetic attraction from the predator class. Every crook and criminal in the world says, aha, I can go into government service, and I'll be the one to put people in prison instead of myself going into prison. And I can steal all I want to in the name of protecting and helping the downtrodden.
Yes.
And that's really the game that goes on. And we create it when we think that government should be the entity that's going to solve all the problems in the world. We create that magnet, and we create our own destiny of slavery when we do that.
Yes, we do. Before we get too late or anything, we've already done about 30 minutes already. Let's get into the Red Pill Expo. What is the Red Pill Expo? And I see on your Facebook page you have Red Pill Expo, Instagram, Need to Know News on Twitter, redpilluniversity.org, realityzone.com, Need to Know News, redpillexpo.org.
Too much, isn't it? In fact, I think we've created a monster. We have too many things going on at the same time, and they're all little departments, you might say, of the same movement.
Certainly.
At the core of it is Freedom Force International. It's an organization I created back in 2002 of people like us, and probably many people listening to your or watching your program, people who really care about the future of the world and their community and their country and the world. They really care. They have this crusader gene that I keep talking about. Not everybody has it, I'm sorry to say. Most people, I think, really, oh, that's interesting, but they don't have that feeling of responsibility that says, gee, this is terrible. It needs to be changed. It needs a champion. It needs a crusader. They just don't care. As long as I've got my whatever it is that's important to them, got my color TV, I've got enough money in the bank, I've got food on the table.
They're still comfortable.
You can't change any of that stuff anyway. The world will always be like that, you know. They just don't feel personally responsible. But there are some of us that do. And fortunately, we don't need a lot of people. to change the world. And I mean this seriously. Have to realize that all of the great movements of history, either upward or downward, have been the result of the actions of a very small group of people.
10%.
Way less than 10%.
Well, studies have shown that 10% of very, very committed people can change something, whatever something is.
And I'm glad you said that, because there are different strata. I think I would even go a little higher and say that 15% of the population really have the interest in doing something of significance that's outside of their own benefit. They would have that altruistic view. They want to do something because it's just the right thing to do. But not many of them are motivated to dedicate their lives to it or to make sacrifices for it. So you've got, it's true, it's about 15% that make things happen. But that 15% is led by a smaller group who really are dedicated. And even that group has a smaller segment within it who you might consider to be the thought leaders and the real driving force for it. Take, for example, the American Revolution. Now, I know this is an international audience, and I don't mean to sound, you know, jingoistic or anything like that. I just happen to know more about American history than most histories of other nations. And the world knows about the American Revolution. It was a breakaway from England and all that sort of thing. And that, gee, how did these colonists, these ragtag farmers with no food, no uniforms, hardly any ammunition, how did they defeat the British army, the strongest, most victorious army in the world, you know, sort of, how did that happen? And you think, well, the farmers got together and it was a mass uprising. Not at all. The American Revolution was fought by less than 15% of the population, had about 15% of the people who were openly supporting it. The rest of them were either resisting it and were loyalists, or wanted to just stay out of the debate. Say, well, I don't know about this. I don't know. And they wanted to just stand back and see who was going to win. And then whichever side would win, they were prepared to say, well, that's what I've always said right from the very beginning. I've always supported the king, you know. And so it was 15%. But now of that 15%, it was only about 3% or less that actually picked up a weapon and confronted the soldiers. And of the 3%, there was just another 3% of that which provided the leadership for those soldiers who needed to be organized, you see. And of those, you look at the number of people who signed the Declaration of Independence and the people who signed the Constitution when it was finally drafted, and the few writers like Thomas Paine who put out the pamphlets and provided the information to generate support for the revolution. You're looking at an extremely small percentage of the population that actually made it happen. And that's true in all revolutions. It's true in all social movements. It's true in all religions. It always comes from an amazingly small group of people, but those people are dynamite. They dedicate their lives to it. They're scholars in what they're doing. They're serious about it. They're willing to make any kind of a sacrifice to promote the things in which they believe. Now, that's reality. At first, when I saw that, I thought, you know, I don't think I like this. It sounds like the American revolutionary leaders were elitists. And then I came to the realization they were. Those are the people that were in the government positions in the colonies. They were the representatives in the legislatures. They were the judges. They were the ones who led the militia and trained the militia. The colonies had, you know, armies, little militias. They had taxes. They had courts. They had printing presses. They had shops. And you look at the people involved in the American Revolution, they were the ones at the tops of these little clusters of authority and influence. They were the shop owners. They were the ones with the printing presses. They were the ones in the legislature. They were the ones who were in control of the militia and so forth. And so they were, no question about it, the elite. But thank God they were an elite which was not interested in just building a system for their own aggrandizement and their own embellishment of their own profits and power. They actually, it was an amazing America, they actually decided, no, we want to build a system for the first time in history that doesn't put us up in the position of King George and his court, but to prevent that from happening to anybody. It was the first time that they, the winners of a revolution said, well, we're not going to put ourselves in the same positions of our enemies. We're going to create a new system where this kind of a system can't be, cannot be developed again. So anyway, once you realize that the world has always been determined by a few, history has always been determined by a few, an elite. And it probably always will be because that's human nature. Then your perspective begins to shift a little bit and you begin to think, well, okay, what elite is it going to be? Is it going to be an elite of collectivists who want to build a system like a big anthill where there's the queen ant and the worker ants and you know, everything is, you're regimented, there's no freedom, there are a few ants at the top and, you know, very unhuman type of a social structure? Or do you want to build a system based on the principle of individualism, where people are free as long as they don't interfere with the lives, liberty, or property of their fellow human beings? They're free to do whatever they want to do. And so I came to the conclusion, and a lot of my friends now agree with me, fortunately, is that we have to be an elite that has no axe to grind for our own profits, our own advantage. But there's something in us that makes us want to build a system that's better than what we have. And we have to be the elite, the thought leaders, the organizers, the ones who make the sacrifices and the ones that get out there and build this movement, ideological movement. And it only is going to, and here's the punchline, it only is going to take somewhere between 1 and 3% of the population to do that.
Yes, but the that's quite a large number when you think about 340 million people here in America.
It is. It's a large number, but percentage-wise, it's very encouraging because I used to worry about the fact that everybody I talked to, nobody seemed to care. My neighbor, you know, is out there pushing a lawnmower. He's a good guy and all that, uh-huh. But he doesn't want to talk about these things. He doesn't care as long as he can watch his football on Saturday or and his wife wants to watch Dancing with the Stars or whatever. Or they, I don't know. They're into other things. They're great people. But they're not, they don't care about the things we're talking about. And I thought, nobody cares. We can't win this war. But so it's encouraging to know that I don't need many people percentage-wise. If I just could convince 3 out of every 100 people I talk to, just 3.
Exactly.
To do something and to join this movement, we would have it made.
Exactly. That's that kind of ties into what why I'm doing this. I started listening to Alex Jones down there in Austin, Texas, in very early 2009, and I'm going through my studies in college, and I'm in journalism school, mass communications. I'm listening to him, and I'm listening to him, and you've always heard the mantra, or we have always heard the old mantra, why isn't somebody doing something about this? Why isn't somebody doing something about this? Why isn't somebody doing something about that? And I've heard Alex Jones say several times, he is trying to, he says the same message a lot of the times, almost every day. He's trying to replicate himself. And then it occurred to me, you know, why isn't somebody doing something about this? I used to say that. And then it occurred to me, well, I am somebody. I can do something about this. And I have been.
Well, that's it. And we come back to your question now about Freedom Force and Red Pill and all of that. That is, I shouldn't have stopped, but I find myself talking too much. So I think I better just stop and let somebody else throw something in now and then. But I was on a track in a way because I wanted to explain a little bit about Freedom Force and where that fits with the rest of these other structures. And it's exactly what we're talking about now with Alex wanting to replicate himself and so forth. And so with the idea that any kind of a significant movement on behalf of liberty, individualism, security, prosperity, humanity, I like to think. They're trying to get rid of our humanity. They want to make us transhumans now, so we'd be like little robots and we'd be easier to control. Any movement like that is going to be led by probably 1% or thereabouts of the population. But that 1% has to really know what they're up against. They have to be scholars. They have to be super dedicated. They have to be they just have to have that mentality that they're not going to give up. So that's where Freedom Force comes in. Those the people in Freedom Force are of that caliber, small number of people. We can't win a war against collectivism with just that. I studied our collectivist opponents and the organizational structures that they have created, and they're brilliant. I don't buy their ideology or their ethics. You know, they're willing to use anything, lie, cheat, steal, murder, anything to achieve their goals. I don't want to do that. That's not part of what individualism is about. But I had to admire their strategy. And their strategy was that when they created their little hardcore leadership group, they deliberately created another group around it that had more membership without revealing to them that they were actually being led by the smaller group. This, by the way, was all explained pretty well by Cecil Rhodes when he created his secret society. Many people don't know that Cecil Rhodes, one of the wealthiest men in the world, left his vast estate through some wills to create a secret society of which the Rhodes Scholarship is merely the most visible part. Rhodes Scholarship is a recruiting arm of the secret society, but the real organization is behind that. We know about this because a fellow by the name of William Stead, who was a member of the secret society, was chosen to be the administrator of Rhodes' estate. And Mr. Stead, for some reason, wrote a book about it and told us a lot about what was going on. Rhodes himself told us a lot about what was going on. Some of his handwritten notes have survived, and they're in the British Library. So we do know that they consciously imitated the organizational structure created by Adam Weishaupt, who is generally known as the originator, founder of the Illuminati, the original version of the Illuminati. And Weishaupt said, yeah, we create the inner core, then we have a circle around it. We call it the round table, a circle of initiates, and then we have a larger group around it, and we'll call that something else. That's the round table, actually. And then we have another group around that, and then finally we have a huge group. It might be political parties. Each of these rings gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and they all are following influence from the center without knowing it, because that's where the ideas come out. And so Rhodes instituted this strategy consciously when he created the Royal Institute for International Affairs. You find all those organizations in all of the former protectorates of the British Crown, in Canada, you know, and Australia, and right now you can go to the telephone directory and look for the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and they're there. When they created it in the United States, they decided not to call it that, because in America, there was a feeling we didn't want anything royal. And so we had to have a new name. They called it the Council on Foreign Relations, which is, in the view of many people, including myself, I think that the Council on Foreign Relations is what we might call the hidden government of the United States. Has a little over 4,000 people, and none of them some of them get into government, and they're well known. You know them because we haven't had a lot of presidents of the United States who are members. Almost all of our secretaries of state have been members of that group. Generals, Supreme Court justices. The major positions within government are filled by members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Almost all of our universities have at their presidential level and board of directors members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Almost all of the major news channels, ABC, CBS, NBC, Ted Turner, all of the broadcasting systems, all of the major tech industries, all of the major corporations, all of the think tanks, the tax-exempt foundation, look at the heads of these organizations. And for some reason, they're all heavily represented by the Council on Foreign Relations. And this is not an accident. This is a part of the Cecil Rhodes strategy. He said, if you want to conquer the world, you don't do it with guns and bullets and bayonets. You do it by infiltrating into their power centers, their political parties, their media centers, their universities, their think tanks, their labor unions, their social service organizations, everything like that. And you just control it from the top. And people are like sheep, he said. We'll have a herd instinct and we'll follow our leaders. So to run the world without people knowing that you're running the world from a secret society point of view, you first of all know what it is you want. And those are all of your members agree on that. And then they go out and go into other organizations that implement that, whatever strategy they come up with to see that what they want happens through those organizations. And it works. I mean, it works. I could see it working. It's how we lost control of America. It's how most of the countries in the West have lost control to this hidden group of people that we don't even know that they belong to an organization. But, and some of them don't, by the way. But the only reason they're in positions is because they're approved by those who do. They're there because they're all collectivists. They wouldn't be there. They wouldn't be allowed into those positions unless they were dyed-in-the-wool collectivists. And so you don't have to give them orders of what to say and what to do. They're collectivists. They dream it up for themselves. And, of course, they have to agree on the globalist aspect, too. They can't really be national collectivists. They have to be international collectivists so they can create this new world order that they all, that they insist on making their prime goal for the near future.
Certainly.
So having said all that, I studied that and I said, okay, why can't we at least use some of the strategies of building circles of influence? That just makes sense. In fact, it's a natural phenomenon even without any secret societies to do it. I mean, that's how society always develops. You have people in the local church, for example, that say, hey, Charlie, we need somebody on the board of directors over here, very influential position. I'd rather have someone from my church be there with me so we can make sure that the principles that we believe in are protected and advanced. It happens naturally in society, but these fellas at the council really perfected it, you know. And so I thought, why don't we just do that? So I thought, all right, if we go back to the Freedom Force, I mean, 1% of the population is not very much. We need help. So let's create an organization around Freedom Force with a broad view. We don't have to insist that everybody be ready to dedicate their lives to this thing, right? As long as they have the passion for it and believe that it's the right thing to do and are willing to work hard, we'll have an organization for that. And we don't have to make sure that they have read all the books and are capable of entering into a debate on collectivism versus individualism, all these things. Just we want good people who are willing to help us and work for these causes. And so let's find a way to build an organization around that with a more relaxed approach to it, with a more appealing concept than let's go study collectivism versus individualism. So we got the idea that maybe we should take the popular meme called Take the Red Pill, you know, comes from the Matrix movie, the sci-fi movie.
Yes,
about 20 years ago. Yeah. So the theme everybody knows, but take the red pill and break out of the illusion. See life the way it really is. And the blue pill, if you like to live in your illusion, go take the blue pill and you go back and you're in your trance and you don't know what's going on, but you're happy. So I said, let's try that. So we had a Red Pill Expo in 2017. It was our first one. And it was a smashing success. People came from all over the world. And we knew we had found the right theme. All good people, not all of them ready to dedicate their lives to this mission, but still they had they have their families to take care of. They're concerned about the future, just like all of us are. And so they came on board. And we thought immediately, well, we have to have something that doesn't happen just once a year. I mean, this is a raging battle. It goes on every day. How can we do this sort of thing every day? Then the idea came up, we'll have a Red Pill University, which is like a Red Pill Expo, except it's 365 days a year. and it's basically online. Part of that concept is to establish campuses also at the local level, everywhere. Because if you don't have boots on the ground, people meeting regularly and doing projects of public interest at the local level, you really don't have much influence. If you're just dependent upon cyberspace, as important as that is, but if that's all you do, you'll never build a real movement. All movements have to be built with people on the ground, meeting face to face, learning to know each other, to trust each other, to work together. And so our next goal is to build campuses of Red Pill University everywhere. And so that's the basic unit we have. We have Freedom Force, which is the think tank, you might say, behind it all. And we're not hiding any of this. I mean, our enemies have to hide it. We're proud of it.
Yes.
We just don't want to push it in people's faces if they want to know. This is how it works. Yeah. Anybody wants to know what Freedom Force believes in, boy, it's there. We want you to come and read our Creed of Liberty, Creed of Freedom, Creed of Freedom, and our Code of Conduct. It's important.
Yes.
But for those who don't want to get into all of that, just want to get out and get some action and get some changes done, we've got the university and the expo. So, well, that's enough.
I find it very, very, I don't know if ironic is the correct word or not, but I've spoken to people all over the world, and there are some universities. I know that I think there's one up in Canada somewhere that is actually teaching a class called Conspiracy Theories. I thought maybe I'd get your thoughts on that. And I think that there probably are more.
Well, my thoughts on that are pretty straightforward. I think, first of all, it's a very healthy move, unless it's some kind of a deception where they want to just teach everything they teach will turn out to be just a fraud.
And correct.
So if this was just a theory and a bunch of idiots believed it was true, you know, like the hollow earth theory or something like that. Now, if they're really sincere, then my reaction is that, well, that's wonderful, but I don't know why they would call it a conspiracy theory class. Why don't they just call it a history class?
Truthful history. Yes.
I mean, history, the most common component in history is conspiracy.
Yes, it is.
Almost everything that happens in history starts with a conspiracy of some kind.
Certainly.
So if you want a course on conspiracies, let's just teach history the way it really happened.
The true history, yes.
True history, yeah.
Well, actually, we've only got like 2 minutes before the end of the hour. You've given me about 55 plus minutes here, and I really appreciate that.
Well, I hope it's useful. I do a lot of rambling, as you know, but you asked for it, so I was willing to jump into it. Well, so I would like to invite anybody that wants to know more about this at the deep level to come to freedomforceinternational.org and spend some time there. We got some papers. One of them is called, lots of stuff to read. You read the Creed of Freedom, the Code of Conduct. And there's a series of essays called The Future is Calling. There's one particular essay called The Chasm, in which we talk a lot about the difference between individualism and collectivism. So that's for the person that wants to really get into the academic aspect of this, the ideological side. But for those who want to get into the action and just start to make things happen, and I hope there are 10 times or 100 times more people who want to do that, look us up over at Red Pill Expo. Right now, we're planning for the expo on November 8th and 9th. And for those that might watch this by recording in the future, the year is 2019. So we're looking forward to our Red Pill Expo on November 8th and 9th, 2019, in Mesquite, Nevada. That's a little bit north of Las Vegas.
Yes, it
so
is.
So look that up, and I look at those speakers and the topics. So we're going to have some amazing topics. One of them I just dump on you here, just popped into my mind. Everybody's so concerned about these mass shootings, and there's a public outcry, or seems to be, that, oh, we've got to get rid of the guns because the guns are causing these mass shootings. Well, we have a special program for you that shows that, no, it's not the guns. The guns don't shoot themselves. The guns are shot by people, and there's a certain commonality that you might not have heard about between those people. And that is almost all of them, if not all of them, are heavily addicted to
psychotropic drugs,
the antidepressant drugs. That is the cause of these shootings. And because those drugs, if you look at the little packages that come with them, they're right there. I mean, a little fine print, but it's all in there. One of the well-known side effects of these drugs is impulses of homicide and suicide.
Anger, and yeah. Hallucinogenics.
Anger and confusion and hallucination. They might think they're killing wild animals.
Certainly.
They might think they're killing a python that's attacking them or something. You don't know. And so that's one of our programs that would be there. Of course, we have a major program devoted to 5G technology. It's not what you think. There's an illusion there. Come take the red pill on 5G. Take the red pill on mass shootings. Take the red pill on vaccines. All of these issues will be discussed there. So come to the website, look at the speakers, and I hope you're tempted to come. Now, if you can't make the trip, this will all be available online at a very reasonable cost. And by the way, in order to see it online, you enroll as a student at Red Pill University just for 1 month. It's a trial month enrollment. And as a student, you get to watch all of these videos. It's a benefit of being a student. Not only these, but all the previous expos as well. You can spend a month watching expo meetings so far. So come on board and take a look. And I hope to see you in Mesquite on November 8th and 9th.
Well, thank you. That's a great invitation. And I might come out there this time or next year or whatever. Yeah. But I also want to do presentations myself, go to like libraries or people's homes or whatever, classrooms or. Mm-hmm. I want to do that someday myself, too. But thank you again for coming on.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's been a pleasure talking at you and with you. And maybe next time I'll ask you about your own research.
Because my own awakening? Yes.
Yes.
I can tell you about that someday. Absolutely.
All right. You got a short version?
Yes. I was listening to Alex Jones. I was in the critical thinking class, Logical Fallacies. CRT 205 is actually what the class was called. And listening to Alex Jones, and he's talking about two political pundits bickering back and forth like they do on the Fox or CNN, whatever it is. And he said that's a classic strawman attack. And I'm sitting here listening to him and studying in my class, and I said, wow, I know what a strawman attack is. So I went and searched up the YouTube clip that he was talking about, and there it was right in front of my face, the practical application for logical fallacies and rhetorical devices.
Yeah. Very important topic. I hope somebody soon can do a really good study of controlled opposition.
Yes.
It's collectivism's strongest weapon.
Yes, it is. Well, thank you again, Ed.
Okay, thank you again, and good luck. See you next time.
Have a good day. All right, everyone. Yes, very, very informative show, and he's a very, very good inspiration, and he's been a great man in this movement for almost 60 years now, I think he said. So I'll be right back. I've got two more guests coming on, and I'll be right back.